In this country, most people live in cities while their food is grown out in the country by others. But advocates of urban agriculture say a lot of food can be grown in the city, providing a remedy for food deserts and other urban problems. I'm Jim Meadows. Today on Focus, we'll look at the urban agriculture movement from two different viewpoints. Will Allen talks about how he enlisted community support in launching his urban agriculture organization, Growing Power, in Milwaukee. And University of Illinois Crop Sciences Professor Samuel Wortman talks about the environmental challenges urban farmers face. Urban agriculture, today on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. The urban agriculture movement defies the concept that food just comes from rural areas. And in doing so, its practitioners are finding more benefits for growing food in the city than simply having something to eat nearby. And these benefits can range from social to economic to environmental. There are also challenges to growing food in the city. And later on Focus, I'll talk with Professor Sam Wortman. He heads up the Urban Agriculture Research Lab and the Department of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois. But right now, let's talk to someone who left a non-farming job to start up an urban farm. He's Will Allen, the founder of and CEO of Growing Power, which operates farming operations in Milwaukee and in Chicago. He will be speaking on the University of Illinois campus tonight, Tuesday night. I believe that's at 7 p.m. at the Illini Union. Will Allen, welcome to Focus.
It's great to talk to you this morning.
Well, it's great to have you with us, and I'm wondering, I understand you grew up on a farm yourself?
Yeah, I grew up on a farm right outside of Washington, D.C., right on the border of Bethesda and Rockville, Maryland.
And, after that experience, were you ever thinking of a farming career yourself? Because it sounds like that's not what you did for starters.
No, when I left the farm at 18, I had 100 scholarship offers to play basketball at colleges and universities around the nation, and I said, I'll never go back to that farm again. But I guess you should never say never.
And you played basketball, you played in the old ABA, you played in Europe, and later on you had, I understand you worked for Procter & Gamble.
Yeah, I worked for Procter & Gamble in sales and sales technology, and then I also farmed. I got back into farming over in Europe. One of my European teammates' family had a farm. I went out on the farm, and I guess I had this hidden passion for farming, and I wanted to farm, so I got 25 chickens and started growing food, and that's where I got that was a transformative moment back in the 70s.
That was back in the 70s, but later on when you were back in the U.S., and you were in Milwaukee, I understand, then.
Yes. Yes, my wife was from the Milwaukee area. We moved back here with our three children, and I had this burning desire to farm, so I started farming, and I got up to 100 acres. I was working two jobs, with Procter, and also farming and going to farmers markets and selling wholesale back in the 70s and the 80s, and one day I was driving down the street, actually going to one of my Procter & Gamble accounts, and I ran across the last remaining farm in Milwaukee on Silver Spring Drive, and I was looking to sell my farm produce. It's one of the busiest streets in Milwaukee, and in what's called a food desert with the largest housing project 5 blocks away, so I thought the location would be great. To sell my farm produce and to grow food in the city, and that was 21 years ago.
Now, before that, you had been growing out in the country near Milwaukee, I take it.
Yeah, I was growing out in Oak Creek, had 100 acres of produce I was growing and selling, and was just looking for another new retail space, and the fact that this was a food desert, I thought this would be a great place to bring my good food naturally grown into the city. And I I started working with the youth in the community, and that's how I got sucked into doing this nonprofit organization that we have today.
Well, before we go further, I'd like to invite listeners in on the conversation. Perhaps you do some farming in the city yourself, whether it's raising backyard chickens. That's been an issue in Champaign-Urbana recently. Or growing crops in a community garden or something bigger. We'd like to hear from you on the program today. Call with your questions and comments at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free at 1-800-222-WILL. And you can email us at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. How did you start getting involved with youth and working this farm in the city?
Well, I helped a youth group that wanted to grow an organic garden, and nobody would help them, and I had some space behind the greenhouses on the farm, and it was late in June back in 1995, and I plowed up the area and helped them, gave them some starts and gave them some seed, and they wanted to go to our farmer's market in the inner city, and I helped them set up a stand, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel wrote a front page story about me working with the kids, and so that's how I got sucked in, working with these kids, and my friend said, you should start a nonprofit, and I said, well, I don't want to sit in the office and do that kind of work. If you guys want to do the administrative work, I would do it. And that's how I got started. And today we've grown from those days back in 95 to an organization that now has 25 acres of greenhouses in the city, about 27 farms, and we do work all over the globe now.
Well, I'm wondering, with the operations that you have in the city, are there special challenges to farming inside the city compared to rural areas?
Yeah, there are some different challenges. Of course, a lot of the land is asphalt and concrete. So one of the things that we do is grow soil. We compost on a very large scale to be able to grow food on asphalt, concrete, rooftops. There's a lot of vacant land in Midwest cities like Milwaukee and Chicago and Detroit and Flint, Michigan, really all over the Midwest and even in eastern cities. But you have to have compost to be able to grow because the soil is contaminated because these were heavy industrial cities and there's a lot of lead and arsenic and a lot of things in the soil. So what we do is we put 2 feet of new soil on top of the existing hard pan clay and asphalt to concrete to be able to do that. So last year we collected 40 million pounds of carbon and nitrogen inputs and composted that to be able to grow the food that we grow in the city.
Okay. Having that newly produced soil, as it were, is that something that has to be constantly, you know, maintained and added to, or are you able to reach a stable position with that soil?
Well, because it's compost, it shrinks a little bit. We top it off each spring, of course, to bring it up to that level of 2 feet from the base. But the thing about soil, when you're growing food, it's all about the soil. It's all about the fertility of the soil. So this compost is high fertility soil, and that's what's really important to our health, to make sure that we get food that's high in nutrient, that's what it's all about. That's where the rubber meets the road with our health, is about the nutritional value of the food that we eat. And our soil overall today is 50% less fertile than it was 50 years ago. So
that's just U.S. U.S. soil in general, you mean?
Yes. So this is something we have to do. This is something that for us to have a sustainable food system, we have to have this urban-rural connection. We can't grow all the food in urban areas. But we're also losing rural farmland, and we're losing rural farmers. So one of the things that we do as an organization is train farmers on how to grow more intensively on less space. looking at agriculture instead of hectares and acres in terms of square footage, 44,000 plus square feet an acre. You want to make sure every square foot counts. And to be able to do that, you have to have high fertility soil to do that.
Okay. I'm wondering, what sort of crops are you growing in your various operations?
Well, we grow 150 different crops, from fruit, vegetables, edible flowers, herbs. We also do aquaponics, so we're growing fish, and we train people how to do aquaponics, which is something I think is very appealing to the young people today. As I go around the country, young people are very interested in aquaponics because it's not like going out into a field when it's 28 degrees and you're digging carrots and pulling carrots out of the ground, and it's raining and snowing, and you're inside a building or inside a greenhouse, and you're growing plants and fish. So you're getting protein from the fish that you grow, and you're also getting vegetables that we so badly need in cities. And the fact that we have so many vacant buildings in cities like Chicago and Milwaukee and, like I said before, Detroit, that this is something that is growing. As a matter of fact, we trained 140 people last year to go into aquaponics.
Now, the people that you work with in your programs now, it's young people, but is it adults as well?
Oh, yeah, it's multi-generational. I mean, one of the good signs that in agriculture today is that I would say about 70% of the folks that want to get involved in the food system on some level, in the hundreds of different categories of jobs, are under 40 years of age. But overall, they're people from all walks of life come to our trainings that we do from January through June in Milwaukee.
Okay. This is interesting to me because you must be working with a lot of people who essentially are starting from zero as far as farming experience.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it's good that they're starting from zero. They don't bring any baggage into this new concept of growing in the city and growing on smaller spaces and the learning. So they don't come with that barrier of, I kind of know how to grow stuff in this kind of way, because this is a little bit different than growing food in a rural area and row crops and that sort of thing. But everybody's welcome, and it's an opportunity for folks that have been farming to also make that transition from conventional farming to this new type of farming that I think is much more financially beneficial than what's going on out in rural America. And the industrial model of farming.
We're talking with Will Allen. He's the founder of Growing Power with urban farms in Milwaukee and also more recently in Chicago, and also training programs in various parts of the country from time to time. You can call in with your comments and also your thoughts about urban farming, maybe your experiences as well. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Will, I'm wondering, you grow the food. Where does it go once you harvest it?
Well, we have a very diversified marketing scheme that goes to everybody in our community. So my thing has always been that we need to get the same good food to all people in our community and find avenues to be able to do that. And so we go to farmers markets. We have our own farm stands. We have CSA. We have a winter farmers market that we operate at our warehouse in Sussex, Wisconsin. We sell to Cisco. We've gotten large enough with our 25 acres of greenhouses and over 300 acres of outside production to be able to deliver to wholesalers. So we're getting our food to everybody in the community, regardless of their economic situation. And the way we do that is we've been able to cut the production costs by, again, growing our own soil, by using renewable energy. We use a lot of renewable energy. And we're growing year-round. So we, inside hoop houses all over the city, we have 8 ponds in Chicago. So we've been able to get our food into the Walgreens stores that now carry some vegetables in Chicago. So our mission is to make sure everybody has access, because that's what it's all about. When you talk about these food deserts or people that don't have access to food, it's really about access, giving people access to the same food.
Give me an idea of when you're talking about a food desert in a large metro area like Milwaukee or Wisconsin, what does someone, you know, without an operation like Growing Power or some other urban agriculture going on there, what sort of options is somebody going to have for groceries?
Well, their options are very limited. Many people that are below the poverty level or at the poverty level or even middle income folks really struggle to be able to get out of their communities, and sometimes it's 6 miles away from the closest retail grocery store because those grocery stores started pulling out in the 70s. So they're kind of stuck eating a lot of fast food, low-quality food, or from corner stores where they don't have many choices. And in our climate, when it gets really cold, people have a hard time traveling outside of their community to be able to purchase food. You can look at a city like Detroit where there are no retail grocery stores until recently, when Whole Foods, which I really applaud them, has just built a store in Detroit. That's the only retail grocery store of name in Detroit, in a city that has 169 square miles of territory of land, 90 square miles of vacant land. So there's tremendous opportunity to be able for folks to get into urban agriculture and grow some of their own food, and that's what's happening in Detroit. And regardless of what we hear about Detroit, there's some good things going on there in that city in terms of people taking it upon themselves to start growing some of their own food and improving their lives that way, because that's the most important thing in our lives is our food, even though we take it for granted. That's the only way we're going to end the healthcare crisis is to be able to grow healthy people. So, you know, our food is supposed to be our medicine. So this is what this movement that I call a revolution, the Good Food Revolution, is all about. It's about improving people's health, which also improves communities as well.
You talked about training you know, people to farm, not just in your programs, but beyond that. Do you have you seen other operations start up in other cities, people who started training with you?
Oh, yeah. We have 15 regional training centers around the U.S., and I get calls almost daily from communities around the country and around the world to help them start a food system. So it's small communities like Green Bay, Wisconsin, we just visited. You'd think a city like Green Bay doesn't have food deserts, but they do. I was just out in Seattle, Washington area. Again, they want to build a better food system in a city that has a lot of wealth. And you look at it and say, well, Seattle doesn't have food deserts, but they do. So they exist in all communities and rural communities as well, because our agricultural system has changed, and many of these rural communities are in as bad a shape as urban communities. So we're kind of all in this together, and we really need everybody at the table to figure out how do we change our food system, how to a local food system that we used to have years ago, to a healthy food system. But one organization or one group of folks can't do it. Farmers can't do it by themselves. We need the corporate community on board and universities on board. We need medical folks. We need engineers and architects. We need to really design these food systems that work in these communities around the country.
Well, I have a tweet in from Lisa, and she was wondering if Growing Power has any partnerships involved with institutions like, say, food banks or correctional facilities, just as a couple of examples of places that you might be providing food for?
Yeah, we have it's very difficult in correctional facilities because everything is pretty much in-house. But we work with training some folks from correctional facilities in terms of doing vermicomposting, worm farming, and there's some worm farms on some correctional facilities. We also work with food banks. Not only do we donate food to food banks, but we also pick up their waste and turn that into compost, their food waste. Because they, a lot of times, the food that they get from wholesalers only has one day shelf life, and they don't sell it, so they create a lot of waste, and we're able to turn that back into compost that grows healthy food.
That sounds like a very constructive arrangement. Yes.
Yeah, and I one of the things I'm encouraging many of these food banks is to buy instead of the canned foods that they're giving people is to do more gleaning directly from farms and also to purchase fresh vegetables so that they can improve the health of the people that they're serving.
Well, what are some of the big challenges as far as being able to expand urban agriculture? I mean, what challenges do you see ahead that need to be overcome?
Well, I think land is, we're a land trust organization, and we just started after 20 years, really, activating our land trust status to be able to get land on a long-term basis because, you know, transforming a vacant lot is a very costly situation. When you think about every yard of compost is about $100 a yard. So for good, something you can grow in. So that's one of the big issues. The other big issue is that we need to grow farmers. We don't have enough farmers to be able to grow this good food. So it takes, you can't grow a farmer overnight for in a year or two. So it's an ongoing thing. I've been farming for over 50 years, and you're always learning new things. You can't ever get too cocky or complacent and think you know everything because all it takes is a little bug or a bad storm to really destroy your crop. So you're always learning, and we have to be more innovative in terms of how we're going to grow this food. We're working on a vertical building to grow food because in some cities where there's not a lot of land mass, we're going to have to grow vertically. So the idea of someday looking at a 100-story vertical farm in cities like New York or Boston or Vancouver or Tokyo or San Francisco, this is part of the future, and this is part of what this next generation will be able to develop as we pass on what we've learned to them. And I'm starting to see that happen. As a matter of fact, we're going to build the first vertical farm in the world.
Okay.
In Milwaukee. Which would be a five-story, so we can really learn how to grow inside a vertical farm like that.
Will, I was wondering, Growing Power, of course, is a nonprofit organization. Is there a role, or do you see commercial farmers setting up operations in urban areas?
Oh, yeah, they already are. As a matter of fact, I would say 75% of the folks that come to our trainings are probably going into a for-profit small farm operation.
Okay.
So, you know, and I think that's important that we create businesses, we create jobs, because I believe we can create thousands of jobs by developing these food systems in these local communities.
The potential for growth in urban agriculture in the future, how big is it?
Oh, I think it's tremendous, especially, like I said, with vertical farms, with using rooftops, with growing on asphalt and concrete, growing on vacant buildings. There's so many foreclosed former factories and buildings and that we can use. Building low-cost hoop houses to grow year-round because we need to eat this food year-round. It's one thing about eating food 25 weeks when the outdoor farming is going on, but we need to feed people 365 days of the year, just good local food. And that's possible, and that's one of the things that we had to prove, because there were a lot of naysayers saying you can't grow significant amount of food inside a city or on the exterior of cities. So we have to continue to quantify that we can. We have to continue to quantify and educate people, especially our politicos, who need to be involved in helping us get land. There's a lot of land that's just sitting around in cities. Chicago has 33 square miles of vacant land, 77,000 vacant lots. So that land can be used to grow food rather than sit there for the next 20 years. You know? So there's tremendous potential, tremendous excitement around small farming, and it's a great place for young farmers to start growing inside a city. Land is so expensive. Right outside most major cities, so it's pretty difficult for young farmers to get started. So this is a great starting area for young farmers.
Well, Will Allen, thank you very much for talking with us today. And, of course, you will be on the U of I campus this evening, Tuesday evening, at 7 o'clock to give a lecture at the Illini Union.
Yeah, I'm headed that way right now. So, looking forward to it.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah. And talking to you too.
Take care. And we'll take a short break here on Focus and be back with more discussion about urban agriculture with Professor Sam Wortman of the Department of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois. This is Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus here on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, continuing our discussion of urban agriculture, and we welcome your questions and comments, especially your own experiences with farming in the city, whether it's a garden plot, raising chickens, or perhaps doing something a little more ambitious. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. The phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. My next guest is an assistant professor in the Department of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana campus, and he's also the lead investigator. Sounds like you should have your own TV show. Lead investigator at the Urban Agriculture Research Lab that the department runs. Professor Sam Wortman, thank you very much for being on the show with us today.
Happy to be here.
And how long has urban agriculture been, just an identified subject that it would be something that that your department wants to take a serious look at?
It's been a topic that you can find in the scientific literature for at least a couple decades. It's received most attention from social scientists and urban planners that have been looking at ways to use urban land and looking also at the social issues, which Will touched on quite a bit. But as far as the production side of things, the reason that the Department of Crop Sciences got interested is that we are seeing urban agriculture on a much bigger scale in cities like Chicago. And there are a lot of production challenges, a lot of unique production challenges with growing food in cities. And so Dr. Sarah Taylor Lovell in our department has started doing some research around 2009 on urban agriculture, looking at some of the multifunctional benefits of urban agriculture, things like pollinators that you find in cities, and other benefits like stormwater runoff and things that urban farms can provide to a city. And so I was brought on in 2012 to focus more on some of those production challenges. How can we maximize productivity on urban farms while also maintaining sustainability and increasing profitability, which is a main issue because, as Will mentioned, a lot of these folks are wanting to go into for-profit types of operations on urban farms.
I gather if you go back far enough, I mean like a century or so, and go to cities, you would see more farming going on, that there would be more land available for it, that people would just tend to have livestock because if nothing else, horses were moving through cities anyway, and if you can have horses, you could certainly have other animals as well. So something happened between, say, 150 years ago and now that changed the face of urban agriculture for a time, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And really, the topic of urban agriculture is is somewhat foreign to us in the U.S., but urban agriculture is very prominent in developing countries. And so if you look in the scientific literature for urban agriculture, most of the examples you'll find come from Africa or Latin America. So urban agriculture is kind of a movement right now in the U.S., but it's something urban and agricultural landscapes are already well integrated in many countries around the world.
It is something, and this is really a vague term if I ask you, if urban farming can work. That is, in the larger sense, can it provide food, employment in the long run, or is it just something that, you know, in terms of the long run of agriculture, it's sort of a fad?
Yeah, it's a great question, one that we get all the time. And I think it just depends how you define food, because the role that urban agriculture can really provide is in the way of fruits and vegetables and herbs and those things that Will Allen was mentioning. In my opinion, we're never going to be able to grow all of the grains and meat that we really need to provide a lot of the calories and protein for our growing population in cities. So there's always going to be a role for rural agriculture. We need large acreage to provide grains to feed livestock and provide protein. But there's a really strong niche to be filled in cities to grow nutritious fruits and vegetables and herbs.
Now, Will Allen, I think, touched on something on the environmental challenges he faces, because it just sounds like he's not really growing directly in the topsoil that you might find in a vacant lot. If you were to find a good topsoil in a vacant lot, or even if your backyard if you say had a bungalow in a city neighborhood. I don't know, if you were in Chicago and say you lived in a neighborhood and had a backyard space, How suspicious would you be of the quality of the soil out there?
I would be fairly suspicious. most studies have shown that throughout Chicago, the average background soil lead concentration, for example, is about 400 parts per million. That's right at the threshold that the EPA uses for defining a contaminated soil when you talk about things like building children's playgrounds, for example. And that's quite a bit higher than what we find in other major metropolitan areas. I was just talking with a colleague out in Oakland, California, and he mentioned that the citywide average in Oakland is about 100 parts per million for lead. So it is because, you know, Will mentioned some of the industrial history that we have in the Midwest, cities like Detroit and Chicago, and that has resulted in kind of a long-term environmental problem when it comes to heavy metals and other organic contaminants. And so So people should be, you know, at least aware of the potential for contamination when you're going to grow in your backyard or on a vacant lot. But that also doesn't mean that it's not possible. And there are very common sense types of precautions that people can take that still allow them to grow food very safely in their backyards directly in the soil if they just take some proper precautions, things like wearing gardening gloves, washing your fruits and vegetables. The big thing that I tell people that usually gets a laugh is just don't eat the soil. That's the number one way that people get exposed to those contaminants is through direct ingestion. Obviously, most people aren't taking spoonfuls of soil and eating it, but you might be inhaling it if you're out tilling up your garden. So you just want to be careful that you're not indirectly ingesting it, whether that's on your produce or you're inhaling that contaminated dust.
I'm wondering also, in downstate Illinois, in small metro areas, even industrial ones, long-term industrial ones like, say, the Decatur and Danville areas, and then other towns, Champaign, Urbana, Charleston, or Mattoon, or Springfield, or what have you, do the same levels of risk in soil contamination exist there as exist in the major cities?
Yes, but not to the same degree. So lead is the contaminant that always receives the most attention, and rightfully so. And we do find higher levels in cities like Chicago because of industrial background and also just because of the density of cars that we historically had in those cities and still have. And the presence of lead comes from house paint and gasoline, leaded gasoline, up until the late 1970s. And so the amount of lead contamination that we find in urban soils is fairly proportional to the density of aging housing stock and also just population from those vehicles. So in a city like Champaign-Urbana, certainly we if you're directly adjacent to a house that is fairly old, that most likely was painted with lead-based paints, then soil lead contamination can be an issue. But the source from leaded gasoline in a less dense city, that long-term environmental impact is not going to be as substantial as it is in a city like Chicago.
And if you're in a newer residential area, say a subdivision that was laid down, say, in the last 35 years or so, is it reasonably certain that that things will be a little safer, at least as far as lead contamination is concerned?
I think that would be an accurate assessment, especially most of those newer developments are going to be further from the city core, further from those initial sources of the contaminants. And you're probably, those residential communities are probably on land that was farmland 30 years ago. And so it's likely less contaminated.
Now, we're here in Champaign-Urbana, and there are various community garden projects. We were talking about some of them before the broadcast. From what you know about them, are some of them taking precautions due to possible soil contamination?
Yeah, most are. And the number one way that community gardeners take those precautions is to grow in raised beds. And these raised beds are smaller. They're oftentimes using lumber to create walls and then capping the soil with some type of barrier, maybe even just a landscape fabric, and then filling in with a couple feet of compost. So it's a smaller scale version of what Will Allen does with Growing Power. They essentially create gigantic raised beds on top of vacant lots, sometimes upwards of an acre in size. So these are just smaller versions of what Growing Power does.
Okay. What about, I think you were talking about water runoff in urban areas. Is that something that that urban farming provides a benefit to, or are there risks involved with water contaminants?
That's a good question, and one that we don't necessarily have the answer to yet. There has been a lot of speculation that urban farming, that might be a great benefit of urban farming, as stormwater runoff is a major problem in most U.S. cities. And so the idea is that if we've got this this farm, we've farm with a lot of healthy soil that's going to slowly percolate this water, maybe that's a great way to reduce stormwater runoff. But there's really been no studies to show that that's an actual benefit of urban farming. So that's an area that we're hoping to do some research on in the future.
Okay. We have a call in now. Line one, Dave in Champaign. Welcome to Focus. You're on the air.
Okay. I have a number of people who have pulled out of urban gardening because of theft. Is that a sociological problem? Can you improve the quality of life by having gardens that encourage people to not just walk in and harvest things of their own accord or hang out there or whatever? So that's one problem I have. And the other one is, if you're talking about outer urban buildings, often the soil, the quality soil has been removed, the topsoil, and replaced by lower-grade clay, and then 3 inches of topsoil is brought back in. How do you handle that sort of thing if you're in a more outer urban situation?
Dave, I'm wondering about your first question. You're saying there are instances where people are raiding other people's gardens and just running off with the vegetables?
Yes. How do you handle that?
And I wish I had asked Will Allen that question, but is that a factor that people have to consider? Everything's in close quarters here when you're gardening in the city.
It is, and so many people, many organizations will put up fences around their urban farms because it is a business, and this is their produce is a valuable commodity, and so oftentimes fences are installed. But people can scale fences. And in some cases, you do lose some produce. So, there's unique challenges to urban farming, and humans are one of them. In rural areas, you maybe have more problems with deer that are taking out some of your crops. And in this case, we have people taking out crops. And I suspect that Will and other folks that are part of the urban farming movement would say that it's not an entirely bad thing because if somebody's stealing fruits and vegetables from an urban garden or an urban farm, they probably really need it. And so there's worse things to be stolen than fruits and vegetables, because our hope
can probably even be positive.
Yeah, and so that's an approach that some people take, is they don't necessarily put up fences, is because they say it's kind of this community approach.
Yes.
And there's this idea of community food forests, for example, where they want to try to make it accessible to all. And if that means you want to come and pull it off the tree yourself or pull it out of the ground yourself, then that's a positive impact. And that works really well for the nonprofit organizations. But you raise a very good point for the future of for-profit urban farming.
What about the soil question that Dave brought up?
Remind me what that question was.
You were, Dave, where you were talking about essentially soil being replaced.
Oh, yes.
Commercial building usually takes away the topsoil because it's not good for construction, and then they return a certain amount of topsoil, so enough to grow lawn, but it I can imagine it's not very good for growing crops.
Yeah, and that is a problem. So even if we find that a soil isn't contaminated with lead or other heavy metals or organic contaminants, we still find that most urban soils are of fairly low quality. So compaction is a huge issue, and we run into compaction because of the fact that heavy machinery was used for the initial purposes of that land. And as you mentioned, topsoil is removed and we're left with the heavy clays. And so some type of remediation, if not for contamination purposes, is needed to improve the overall quality of that soil. And so even if we're not going to be growing in raised beds, there's usually a need for some type of remediation through the use of organic amendments. So compost application or some topsoil that's mixed in with that, if you want to call it, native urban soil.
Dave, thank you very much for the call. And that sort of negates the hope I was bringing up, that say if you were living in a newer subdivision, you could possibly avoid the lead contamination problems, but you might be missing a lot of the original topsoil anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We are on Focus on WILL talking about urban agriculture, and right now we're talking with Professor Sam Wortman. He is the lead investigator at the Urban Agriculture Research Lab at the University of Illinois Department of Crop Sciences. You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580, the email address WILL-talk@illinois.edu. You talked a little bit earlier about about pollinators being a benefit, or is that something that's lacking in urban areas when you're farming there?
Well, that was the question that my colleague Dr. Lovell asked a couple of years ago. And because, again, the thought was that maybe urban gardens and community gardens can actually help to increase pollinator populations inside of urban areas. What they found was that pollinators are not necessarily the populations are not necessarily higher in community gardens than you would find in other areas. And so it seems like that's not a huge benefit of urban agriculture, but she is currently and studying other multifunctional benefits that those urban agricultural landscapes could provide to cities.
Do urban farms get the pollination that they need? I'm assuming that they need some just to get by. I don't know exactly how that works as far as the survival of a plant that you're just growing from seed.
Yeah, and that was really the main finding of their study, was that they are having enough pollinators at these urban garden sites. And so they were looking at, you know, does having a buffer strip of, say, perennial flowers around your urban garden, does that increase pollinator populations for your vegetable crops? Or does, you know, proximity to certain things in the landscape, does that increase your pollinator crops? And what they found was that really the abundance of pollinators in urban areas isn't much of a problem. They were finding very abundant populations of pollinators at all of these community gardens. And so that doesn't appear to be one of the challenges of implementing urban agriculture, which is a positive.
Will Allen talked about vertical farming, which I gather is farming on several levels, going up to make up for the lack of available land. How does that work, and how well can that work as far as keeping that sustainable and making sure that everything has the light and the water that it needs?
Yeah, so vertical farming is a great concept, and it's one that's still very preliminary, and it's one that we need a lot of engineers to be working on, because right now the biggest hurdle is energy. Because when you start to grow vertically, and Will mentioned the example of maybe a 100-story building where we're growing fruits and vegetables inside of, the challenge there is that it's very energy intensive and expensive to provide light inside that building, because presumably you're only going to be getting a lot of light on the south side of that building. So you're going to need some artificial light, which is very energy intensive. And then just the amount of heating and cooling in that building to provide optimum temperatures for your crop environment is going to be very expensive as well. And so there's just a lot of technical challenges that need to be overcome before we see something like that become profitable and sustainable.
Do you see any simpler forms of vertical farming where someone might be working with, say, two or three or four levels, not something that they need an elevator to get to?
Yeah, and really, I see what Growing Power is already doing as a form of vertical farming. For example, Will touched on their aquaponic systems. And in those aquaponic systems, they typically have a fish tank that is built down into the ground, and then on top of that, they have a structure where the water runs on top of and is filtered out from plants that are growing directly on top of that fish tank. So you've got two layers there, and Will mentioned maximizing every square foot. But we also need to think about maximizing every cubic foot. And so when you think about something like a greenhouse or a high tunnel, this expensive infrastructure, we need to think about utilizing every cubic foot of space within that greenhouse. And so another example is we're going to be doing some research here on campus and down at our research center in Dixon Springs, where we're going to be growing strawberries in vertical towers. So we're going to be stacking five pots on top of each other for a total of about 4 or 5 feet towers, and growing those hydroponically, so in a soilless media. And we see that as a great way to utilize every cubic foot inside of a high tunnel in situations where maybe the soil is contaminated, so we can utilize hydroponics in soilless media.
I'm trying to get a visual idea of that. If you have pots essentially one on top of each other, in which direction are the plants growing? Are they growing up, or are they growing to the side, or what?
So the pots are staggered, so you can put four strawberry plants in each corner of the pot, and then you stagger them on top of each other. So they're kind of coming out of the corner of each of those pots.
Okay.
And so because it's a strawberry, strawberries work so well because it doesn't put on a lot of vegetative biomass. So it doesn't necessarily need to grow up or out. It just kind of grows in place, and your strawberries grow and kind of hang off the sides of the pots.
And is everything able to get enough light?
Yes. There's been some preliminary research. Originally, when these vertical systems came out, going to that idea of maximizing every cubic foot of that high tunnel space, the original thought was, let's stack these pots, 20 high. Let's put them all the way to the roof of the greenhouse. But of course, light became very limiting. And so more recently, they've scaled back, and four or five pots stacked on top of each other seems to be kind of the optimum number, where the bottom pot is still getting enough light to be economically viable.
And how much savings, I'm not quite sure if savings is the right word, but how many more strawberries can you grow compared to just the flat ground area of soil that would be taken up?
I'm not sure what the exact number is, but it is more profitable to grow vertically in Illinois. That might not be the case in a more ideal strawberry growing environment like California. But some of the preliminary work that my collaborator Jeff Kindhart has done down in Dixon Springs, he's shown that that this vertical system is more space intensive and profitable for Illinois farmers.
One question there with urban farming just comes to mind is there a lot of extra effort needed in order to plant in this sort of specialized environment? And is it worth it in terms of the yields that you get maybe the savings that you get since you're not trucking in food from rural areas?
That's a question that kind of remains to be seen. It is a long-term investment. As Will already touched on, it can be very expensive. He mentioned $100 per cubic yard of compost. So if you're talking about, you know, putting that compost on 1 acre of urban land, it starts to add up pretty quickly. And so there's a very expensive short-term investment. And so work needs to be done to quantify some of the more long-term social benefits, health benefits, and economic benefits in terms of job creation, job training. If you're just looking about the break-even point for year one, year two, year three, it's probably hard to justify that type of farming just economically. But when we look at a longer picture of this, it starts to make a little bit more sense.
Well, I wanted to thank you, Sam Wortman, for talking with us today. Sam Wortman is with the Urban Agriculture Research Lab at the Department of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois. My thanks also to Will Allen of Growing Power, who was on the first half of our program, and he will be speaking tonight, Tuesday evening at 7, at the U of I Alumni Union. And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about urban agriculture in the day's program. Your comments welcome on our website, where you can also find links to Growing Power and the Urban Agriculture Research Lab. That's at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show produced by Lindsay Moon, Jason Croft, our technical director. Tomorrow, we will be looking at the latest proposals for pension reform in Springfield and what their impact might be. This is Focus on WYLL.